Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the LGBTQ Studies channel on the New Books Network. My name is Leo Valdez, and I am your host today. I am here with Dr. Julio Capó, who is a professor at Florida International University in Miami. Thank you very much for being with me today, Julio.
Goodness, thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Dr. Julio Capó is a transnational historian whose research and teaching interests include modern U.S. history, especially the United States' relationship to the Caribbean and Latin America. He addresses how gender and sexuality have historically intersected with constructions of ethnicity, race, class, nation, age, and ability. Dr. Capó also produces public-facing work. He curated an exhibit called Queer Miami, A History of LGBTQ Communities, which won the 2019 Museum Excellence Award from the Florida Association of Museums. He's also published in numerous mainstream publications, including The Washington Post and El Nuevo Día, which is in Puerto Rico. His first book, which we will be discussing today, is called Welcome to Fairyland, Queer Miami Before 1940. Published in 2017, Welcome to Fairyland is the only book on Queer Miami in the first half of the 20th century. It won a number of important awards, including the Charles S. Snyder Award from the Southern Historical Association for the best book written on Southern history. Julio, thank you very much for speaking with me today.
Thank you, and thank you for that very generous introduction. It means a lot to me. Thank you.
Before we get to Welcome to Fairyland, I wanted to ask a little bit about your career, because as I was researching you, I found some interesting factoids.
now I'm nervous.
No need to be nervous. I didn't research too far. Didn't go into Facebook or all those places. But you used to be a journalist before you went into academia. Is that correct?
It is. I worked in broadcast mostly. Yeah.
TV broadcast?
I did. I used to write and produce the news for Miami's local Fox station and ABC stations. Yeah.
Oh, wow. That's really interesting. How was that transition from journalism to academia?
You know, I want to say that it was really generative. I mean, not always easy because, you know, there's some kind of I remember sometimes you would hear people say things like, I'm going to take the journalist out of you. And I was like, I'm not even sure what that means. But I find that there's so many useful skills that come along with doing journalism, right? Like, I mean, what is it that we do when we're when I would write and produce the news locally? I was thinking a lot of the same questions that I was asking as a historian. And even some of our methods, while, you know, they're distinct and different in a lot of important ways. I was used to doing archival work in different kind of archives, like even our media archives or thinking about how some stories are told differently. And I mean, you learn how to be, you become really good with deadlines. It's a good exercise to have in academia, certainly, because deadlines are, you know, you're responsive immediately to what's happening in the news, and you have no time to really kind of procrastinate, right? And you do, you know, you're doing oral histories, though you call them interview, you know, like there's lots of similar skills that I found really helpful And having that kind of background. So I still dabble a lot. I still, as you noted in the intro, it's a passion for me too, to make, it's part of public facing work, is to make sure that the research we produce becomes available, right, to people beyond the academy. How do we translate this work, beyond the university walls, certainly beyond that, right? If we're not doing that kind of work, I'm not sure that it's worth it, right? Like that is, we want to do work that is meaningful to the largest group of people as possible, right? That's how it can be transformative.
Absolutely. I totally agree with you. And I did see that connection between journalism and like public history. And I was going to ask specifically public facing work, the intersections of that with like queer and trans history and museums. And if you could comment a little bit on that, because, you know, you did curate that exhibit, Queer Miami. And yeah, so I wonder how are museums receptive to queer and trans history?
Goodness, this is a great question. It's also a big one. That is, the answer is yes and no. I mean, that is in terms of receptive, certainly. I think part of that is right that so many museums and cultural institutions that are doing good work are really responding to the wants and needs of the community at large. And that is like, you know, when we think about a lot of academic presses or even, you know, kind of venues and spaces, we talk about things like peer review, right? Where people are kind of peer reviewing your work in this kind of anonymous way, usually. I feel like this is what the public does for a lot of cultural institutions and museums, right? That is that you are often, the peer reviews are the general publics themselves. And I love that, right? It keeps all of us really, really honest. And it also makes sure that museums and exhibitions are curated with the community and in response to the community and as part of the community. I think that if it's not right coming, if it's not a community led effort, it's not really kind of reflecting the needs and the wants of, you know, why are we studying this history, right? Why do we need to understand our past? So many museums, especially those that, you know, historically, those who know, you know, LGBTQ studies and history, it was really important for LGBTQ archives to create spaces for themselves as distinct institutions that collected and preserved, LGBTQ pasts, right? I mean, that is especially in response to state erasure and to, particular stories that were told around LGBTQ experiences. It was really important for these cultural institutions, these LGBTQ archives and spaces and community centers to emerge. But a lot of, right, mainstream museums and other cultural institutions have simply never really thought about collecting LGBTQ lives. I mean, how do you tell the history of communities that essentially, right, the state sought to erase, never thought to preserve. And if they did think to share and preserve their stories in really, really narrow, distinct, and often criminalized ways, right, through stories of surveillance, of criminality, of deviancy. So it's recovering these voices and making sure, right, that museums are broadly responding to the needs of its community at large is so, so critical and so important. And a form of activism in and of itself. So it's a treat, I have to say, to curate something for me has become such a fulfilling exercise, because it is really working very, very hands-on with a number of different communities. And in that way, it feels really collaborative and really generative. I have to say, it feeds my soul.
Yeah. I love that. I love that answer. And I love the analogy of peer review within academia to the public in the case of museums. And also, just, you know, emphasizing that queer people are part of the community. So in terms of museums serving the public, you know, that's one thing to keep in mind as well.
Yeah, that's right. I love that. I think that's right. I mean, it's so funny because, you know, we make the parallel, but of course, that's what the Academy is doing too, right? Like, I mean, that's what it should be doing, right? That is in that way that we're all serving general publics. Like that's who our students are. That's who we are. And, it's created such kind of divisions, I think, through professionalization and other processes that really do feel, you know, that it's just so important. Right now, I'm finishing co-curating a new exhibition on HIV/AIDS posters from around the world. And it's been such a treat to think about, you know, as someone who also studies HIV/AIDS, to suddenly revisit these conversations and think how graphic design particularly sent messages of a pandemic, now that we're living in this other moment of pandemicness with coronavirus, the novel coronavirus. When we think about how certain global messages are sent, how do we combat, in a global space and moment, a global pandemic. And it forces us to ask important questions: how they're going to become accessible, how people are going to read them, how people are going to engage with them. And that for me is really exciting, to think about different ways that we can approach the material that we come across. Right. And that's been really fun for me.
Well, yeah, that sounds like a great exhibit. I think it's,
oh, thank you.
Sounds wonderful. And just one other maybe question or comment on this topic, because I think it's so important that I feel like sometimes public history or curating exhibits, there's this like motivation to sanitize certain histories.
Yeah.
And that's what I find a little bit difficult, navigating like the fact that I'm a queer historian and working with like a criminalized archive essentially. And also, you know, the constant moral panics about how queer and trans people are destroying certain quote unquote traditional values.
Yeah.
And so that's a tension. Do you feel that in your own work?
I mean, I like that word, that, you know, the word that you use, sanitize. It's sanitized and often whitewashed, right? So I mean, in literal and figurative ways, to do queer and trans history, and certainly public history, feels like a radical act in so many of these spaces, right? Insofar as you're saying, not only does this history matter, it needs to be preserved, it needs to be understood and engaged with, but at its many intersections across, to tie it into histories of anti-Black violence, of xenophobia, of incarceration, this is what is queer about the work in and of itself, is that it is moving us towards a real kind of reckoning with the past and asking really difficult questions, right? Questions that are often uncomfortable for a lot of people. But that's also how healing happens, I think. So it's moving us in that direction when we do, I think, this kind of work. And I'm not, so much good work is out there. That is, that there's so much great work, that of course inspires the kind of key questions that I think we're asking in queer and trans studies and queer and trans public history, I would say, in particular.
Yeah. I love that idea that using history as something healing.
Yeah.
You know, haven't thought about it that way, or using that word in this context. So thank you for that.
Oh, of course.
So another interesting factoid that I thought, moving a little bit towards your book, is that you wrote your dissertation on the post-1940s period.
Oh my God, yeah.
And then you wrote a whole book on the pre-1940s period. I mean, that's huge.
Yeah, you're very sweet. I guess I should just say with a slight caveat, don't do it. I mean, no, I'm being facetious.
I'll try.
And what I mean by that is, it was, you know, it's a risky thing to do, right, when you're on the tenure track, to kind of take on a new project. But I have to say, as I was revising, so I was a postdoc in American studies and essentially Latinx studies, ethnicity, race, and migration at Yale when I finished my PhD. And I got to talking to so many people at the intersection of a number of fields. And I realized that as I was revising my dissertation, which, yeah, as you noted, is a history of LGBTQ Miami, and really the central role that immigration and changes in kind of inter-ethnic and race relations in the city really played in shifting this movement after World War II, how kind of central it was to understanding where the movement itself went after the 40s and into the 50s in particular. in this, you know, the city of the Americas in Miami. And as I was revising that dissertation for a book, which I have to say I'm revising now, right? That is, I didn't let go of that project, but I felt like I was starting in the middle of the story to write a history of you know, queer history before 1940 poses a number of different challenges, because in large part, right, you're no longer talking about identities like you generally are in a post kind of 1950s way. You're really looking at behaviors and looking at desires and looking at, you know, subjectivities and embodiments and a number of different kinds of, I mean, I'm not saying you don't do that post 1940s or 50s, but that they exist in different archives, they exist in different ways. So it poses a kind of different archival question at the very least post, you know, pre 1940, certainly. I think there tend to be a lot less studies on that earlier period for a number of good reasons, right? It's difficult to kind of assess who is, quote, queer and trans, and are we imposing particular identities or you know, subjectivities, and these kinds of really important and difficult questions. As I was revising that dissertation, I realized that I was starting in the middle of the story in many ways, and I had this kind of ambitious, if not delusional, idea of just saying, like, you know what, I'm going to go back to the archives and see if I can just kind of write a very kind of condensed, and Miami, for a number of reasons, has been seriously understudied and probably seriously misunderstood for a long, long time. And there's a lot of great works that exist on Miami increasingly in the last decade or so. But it is such an important city to understanding the kind of where the nation often goes, and so much of the kind of key political and social questions of the nation, certainly today, and that's also true of earlier. But it's seriously understudied. And there was this kind of impulse for me to kind of say, Miami looked, you know, if we kind of look at these secondary sources, at histories like New York and Los Angeles and San Francisco, Chicago, that's how queer culture developed in Miami too, right? Like, this is just what it looked like. And that's essentially what, you know, what so many of us, you know, kind of end up doing, right? We can't do all the primary research ourselves. We rely obviously on secondary sources. But I realized that not only was I starting halfway, you know, midpoint story, but I also was assuming that Miami's earlier period kind of reflected a lot of what happened in New York, LA, San Francisco. So I had this ambitious plan again to return to the archives and write one kind of condensed chapter, like, here's everything that happened in Miami pre-1940. To kind of get me to where I was in that dissertation and revising that dissertation. And I uncovered such a wealth of materials and archives, especially after visiting the archives in the Bahamas in Nassau, in its capital in New Providence, that made me realize, oh my God, I have a radically different interpretation of this early 20th century moment. And Miami provides us an opportunity to think differently about this moment and encourage new understandings of how things developed in this again city of the Americas and this Caribbean, you know, kind of consciousness, and paying particular attention, right, to experiences of people and queers of color, which is, I mean, in some ways translating to the work I was doing post 1945, but. In this earlier period, just provided us with a kind of different periodization for some of the things we think about during this time, different ways that culture developed, and you know, a lot about how critical race was to the formation of this queer culture, which there was no turning back, right? That is, I suddenly found myself fixated on these new archives that I hadn't covered that I felt I needed to explore and properly research. And then that became Welcome to Fairyland. And now and that exhibition that you noted earlier. So that exhibition covered over 100 and something years of Miami's queer culture. So in writing the you know, epilogue to Welcome to Fairyland, that seemed really easy because I had written a whole book about, you know, like a whole dissertation about it. I was like, I know what happens after the 40s. Anyway, yeah.
That's interesting. Well, there was a lot there about, you know, approach, you know, the hermeneutic approach versus the identitarian approach, and the importance of race and to Miami's history and to queer history in general. I guess to just, you know, dig into the book for the readers, can you tell us, you said you had a radically different interpretation of the first half of the 20th century in Queer Miami and in what you call Fairyland. How did you choose a title Fairyland, and what's the biggest takeaway from your book that listeners should?
Good questions too. Great questions, Leo. So I feel like Fairyland, so Welcome to Fairyland almost kind of chose itself. I have to say, as I was visiting the archives, Fairyland just kept on popping up as like this kind of key term and almost, concept that kept on emerging in so many of my sources. And I kind of was really fascinated by the different ways that this kind of concept of Fairyland had different capital and meaning for a number of different communities. And that's largely how the book is threaded. So, I mean, in some ways, like each chapter is kind of devised and organized, while largely chronological, by what Fairyland meant to a particular group of people. So for some, Fairyland might just be somewhere where you can go play golf in the sun and take a little respite from, like, you know, the industrial north or something, you know, something like that. But for others in the know, whatever that may or may not mean, right, Fairyland represented a kind of space for the fairy, like this kind of, understanding Miami as a place where one kind of broadly defined could transgress gender and sexual norms, even if just temporarily, in this kind of fantastical way that it provided a kind of space for people to, Miami seemed like the Las Vegas of its day. What happened in Miami kind of stayed in Miami. And people often referred to this kind of concept more generally in ways that I found really, I kind of fixated on. I was really intrigued by that kind of concept. And then, of course, for others, Fairyland was never accessible at all. That is, they were really just in existence to be in service of a Fairyland for a kind of white middle class and aspirational upper class kind of culture for a lot of communities of colors, for immigrants, for a lot of queer and trans, people we would understand today as queer and trans, in service of this kind of, tourist economy, right? And there was, so one of the things that I think, this book offers new interpretations of is how important it is for us to understand the emergence of these cultures in this kind of transnational space and moment, right? That is to understand the emergence of Miami's queer culture is to understand the United States' long history of colonialism, right? Of empire building, that we cannot understand the formation of, Miami's Fairyland outside of the United States' violent and often aggressive, right? Certainly relationship to Cuba, to Haiti. And I show examples of this and how certain kind of queer cultures emerge in response to or in opposition to some of these kind of things, right? Certainly to put at the center lots of questions about indigenous removal, of anti-Black violence and incarceration, how kind of vagrant raids, for example, were such a key way of understanding particular moments of queer culture. Even just, the kind of thinking about how queer it might have been for women in Miami Beach to wear two-piece bathing suits, like kind of things we take for granted, perhaps, to have us reevaluate, these competing tourist markets that might have existed, and it certainly did exist in Miami when U.S. empire, right, kind of further was encroaching on Cuba, that one of the ways that Miami allowed its queer culture to emerge was to position itself as a safer place, which was heavily racialized, than the kind of paradise that was being advertised in Havana. These incredible stories that have always been there, but we haven't really thought about them in this kind of queer context. Like, what did it mean for the aviation industry to suddenly thrive and make available an easier trip to places like Havana, for example? It meant Miami it nudged Miami further in this kind of wide open town perspective that we are the most accommodating playground that has so much to do with empire and so much to do, right, with colonialism and neocolonialism. So what this kind of offers us are like new periodizations, new kind of seminal moments. There's a raid, right, that I uncovered in 1937 in Miami on this, this queer bar, which was also a space for sex workers and you know, female, what was then known as female impersonators and male impersonators. It's an incredible space that was, you know, appealing to both tourists and locals alike. And it was raided at least one of the first times, not by the police, at least officially, but by members of the Ku Klux Klan, right? So if we think about how central stories of xenophobia, of anti-Black violence, of incarceration and detention were to kind of the creation of this fairyland, it kind of puts us in a different direction to think about also how we might uncover more of these stories. Like maybe we aren't looking at all the places that, you know, on all the archives that are available to us.
Mm. Absolutely. And I think it was called La Paloma, right?
It was. And I have to say, this is one of the great, I mean, I feel like I'm sound so cheesy, but it's 100% true, I promise. One of the great things about exhibitions and curatorial work and public-facing work is that these community, right, that these stories belong to the community. So as I uncovered the story about La Paloma with the exhibition, for example, a lot of people were like, oh, I think I have a postcard of La Paloma. I just didn't realize that that's what it was. So these kind of, you know, one thing leads to another, and they're like, you know, or they, you know, these are community, much like the history of, and the creation and establishment of LGBTQ archives after the 70s and into the 80s. And all these incredible stories, right, are fed by and created and facilitated by the community themselves, right? I mean, there was this incredible newspaper that was I kept on finding references to the story called this news. It was a weekly alternative newspaper called Miami Life that doesn't exist in any library or research depository or archive. But it seems to have been like kind of like a scandalous newspaper, right, of its time. And it's a very difficult newspaper in many other ways. It was a segregationist newspaper. It covered unlike the kind of mainstream newspapers like the Miami Herald and the Miami News, which the latter is now defunct. And I should note Miami Life, of course, went defunct in the 60s. It covered a lot of, I'm not saying favorably, but it did cover a lot of stories that the mainstream press wouldn't. Things like bootlegging and you know, queer and trans communities. Again, not often in the most, you know, most often not in a positive light, but it does. It covered stories that a lot of, I mean, George Chauncey notes this, right, in his work on Gay New York, that a lot of these presses often did what mainstream newspapers out of, you know, essentially respectability politics were unable or unwilling to do. And I, you know, I contacted the last known owner and one of his ancestors had copies of it in his basement, in or garage, I should say, it's South Florida. And it was an incredible story that helped me piece together a lot of, like La Paloma, the raid on La Paloma, it helped me kind of piece some of that together, you know, corroborating it with other sources that were available. But these, I mean, in all these ways, these are community-led efforts. That is, the community themselves have all these rich stories to tell and help us piece together. It's an evasion of our task, I think, for us to be like, this is too difficult to do, these sources don't exist. Sometimes that actually might be true, but then we also might have to think about what those silences are really telling us, and in which case, you know, we kind of reframe our questions, I think, in different ways.
Yeah, absolutely. Those archival stories of the garage, I love hearing those. I always love hearing those. And you hear them a lot in queer histories and histories of marginalized peoples. In general.
Can I make a small plug if that's okay?
Of course, definitely.
We just won a grant through the Wolfsonian Public Humanities Lab, which I'm the deputy director of here at FIU.
Congratulations.
Thank you. We won this most recent grant is through Florida Humanities and the generosity of Florida Humanities. And through this grant, we are going to digitize those available records of Miami Life. So they'll soon be readily available and digitized to everyone. And I'm so excited. I can't even tell
you. That's amazing. Congratulations. I saw the news of that grant. It's huge.
Oh, thank you so much.
You're going to do a lot of good work. So
thank you. I hope so.
Everybody should check it out.
Yes.
I will as well.
Thank you.
Going back, I did find it so interesting that it wasn't the police. It was the KKK that targeted a queer nightclub. And even just like connecting it to the Pulse shootings too. Like, the thing about your book too, and just, you know, for listeners, it is the chapters do look at different cultures and what you term competing visions of the city.
Yeah.
And there are migrants from the Bahamas who were over-policed and criminalized and who helped kind of build the contours of like the queerness that was emerging, a queer discourse that was emerging.
That's a great phrase. I should steal that. Beautifully done.
and then also on the other hand, there were these elite white queers who had like stakes in the real estate market, material financial stakes in building up this tourist industry. And one of the examples that I wrote down was in one of these, I guess, fairyland resorts, they would employ Black Bahamian migrants to work the gondolas.
Yeah.
And they would have to wear a necklace of live crustaceans.
Yeah.
And you talk about that, you know, the use of humans as props. So my question, I mean, it's a very broad philosophical question, I guess, but when we look at queer history and we really center race and colonialism as you do, and the fact that these elite white queers had the space to have pleasure under the safety net of respectability, of wealth, you know, what is our inheritance as queers?
Oh my goodness, you ask amazing questions. So I have to say that example in particular that you gave about the Black Bahamian workers who were asked to write like essentially, right, serve as props, right, in the service of this tourism. I mean, there were so many examples of the kind of eroticization and fetishization of Blackness in this, and really in the service and into for white male consumption, right? Not exclusively so, but often targeting, right, a very particular idea of this, you know, really racialized and obviously racist, right, perception of Blackness as hypersexual, as hyper available, as highly hyper policeable. I feel like I'm making up words, but like, I mean, you get where I'm at, right? And these are also, and I have to say that they're as someone who write, when we look at these sources and we're in the archives and we're sitting down with these sources, they can be incredibly, incredibly difficult to process, right? That is, as we often just don't talk about the visceral, you know, aspects of the work we do, because it's, you're alone with these records and you're trying to make sense of what is such a difficult idea to process and analyze, because it is so violent. It is so, you know, that these are, and then to put yourself, you know, to really kind of, right, interpret not what this might have meant to us, but right, how this would have been interpreted in this space and time is challenging when we have such a knee-jerk reaction to such violence. So, I mean, it is one of the many difficult aspects of recovering these histories. There's one story where a Black Bahamian woman who, unfortunately, you know, we don't even know her name. It's hard. How do you tell the story of people whose names weren't even recorded? You know, like the dehumanizing effects that the state bureaucracy has on, you know, that immigration records simply don't leave. All these kinds of things are really difficult to process. That she's not allowed into Miami because she's single or unaccompanied. That is, no man was accompanied her and she wasn't married. And she sent back in tears and crying, and that's all we know about her. And there were so many other Black Bahamian women and others like her. And part of the kind of transnational story, right, is that if we just followed the sources themselves and the archives themselves are transnational. If I had kind of followed the narrative that the state, that is the U.S. state, had kind of offered about Black Bahamian laborers, you would get a very particular and really kind of inaccurate idea of Black Bahamian seasonal work, that it was entirely, it was always male driven, that it was, and if you go to the Bahamas, for example, you learn that Black Bahamian women tried to enter Miami in almost equal numbers, but simply often just weren't allowed in. So like even just kind of the story of immigration to one place, right, of course, is emigration from another, which, you know, we know this, but it helps kind of fill the story with texture, especially in the absence of the humanity and dignity and respect that's simply not afforded to so many of these people. This helps kind of recreate the lived experience of people who were terrorized by the state, right? And were so it's in that way. I feel like I lost track of the second part of this question, which was a really good one, and I feel awful that I can't remember it.
We can go back to
okay.
But I remember that archival story of the woman who sunk back in tears, and it was really sad. I'm recalling my own experience reading the book.
It's tough. Yeah.
Yeah. You feel a lot of empathy, you know, across the decades, even if it happened a long time ago.
Yeah.
So talking a little bit about the Bahamas, you totally decenter the United States in the quote unquote histories of quote unquote American cities.
Yeah.
And I love how you frame Miami as belonging to both the United States and the Northern Caribbean. Can you, I was wondering, did you approach, you know, did this come organically from your trip into the archive again? And as you started to get more into the pre-1940s period?
Yeah.
Or did you kind of already know, you know, from your post-1940s research that this was a transnational city and that we can't just look at American cities through this, you know, frame bound by the nation state with supposedly impermeable borders?
I feel like I'm taking scrupulous notes, at least in my head, because you have such a great way of articulating and consolidating these big ideas. So thank you for that, Leo. You know, I think it's a little bit of both. That is, to be fair, because, you know, I had done a lot of research on Miami already, especially the post-World War II era. It's hard to discount Miami as a kind of borderland space and, you know, borderland in a, you know, through waterways, right? That is, we think about this often in a kind of land territorial borderland, but of course it's not exclusively so, that Miami certainly is, right, a kind of city of the Americas and can almost has become a cliche. But, you know, lives in a Latin American and Caribbean consciousness as well. There's no doubt about that, certainly in the post-1945 era. And as the research shows, right, beginning with its foundation, right, beginning in the 19th century, this has always been, right, a kind of contested colonial space among, you know, different empires and different kind of and that's an important part of understanding this history. One of the ways that is, I let the archives speak for themselves, and I feel like that also can sound really cliche, but it's true. One of the things that I uncovered when I went to, you know, when I had that ambitious plan to kind of just write one big chapter on pre-1940 Miami, which of course never happened, and I'm grateful. Instead, it became Welcome to Fairyland. Was that as I was looking at sodomy arrests, which is when, you know, just a small indicator of what anything could look like, but I just wanted a kind of beginning point. Black Bahamians seem to have been overrepresented, right, in a lot of these things. So it led me to go to the Bahamas, right? That was kind of like one of the first moments where I realized I had to make these kind of connections. One of the things that it did for me is that if not only did it decenter U.S., you know, or nation state driven history, it also decentered like this kind of Cuban exceptionalism. Like we too often think of the significance that Cuba has played in South Florida history, which is no doubt very true. But in this earlier period, I would argue that the Bahamas in particular was far more transformative to establishing so many of the power structures, especially in opposition to immigrants and anti-black violence. As Cuba was. And that is, in some ways, it kind of challenged the Cuban exceptionalism of the literature and also, you know, of where even I was looking, right? Because you kind of make assumptions about where you might find these archives. But when you let the archives and the sources in them speak for themselves, it leads you to new directions. So in this way, it was challenging me to think differently about even the kind of early influences or what I imagine might have been the early influences. So that was really generative for me.
Yeah, that's so important, challenging the Cuban exceptionalism.
Yeah.
As I've been reading in Latinx history, it's remarkable how much they are overrepresented, and in particular white Cubans after the Cuban Revolution, because, you know, I'm just reminded of Nancy Mirabal's book, Suspect Freedoms, which brings in black Cubans into also the pre-1940 period.
Right. I mean, it's a dominant narrative that is no doubt really important and really influential, but it is one of many, many narratives, right? Like that is, Yes. And that's, it's, and too often I think we associate it with periodization. So like, you know, post 1959, then the narrative turns, you know, suddenly like the sharp turn to kind of Cuban exceptionalism, which again is, and there's a reason, there's important reasons why that's so, but it also discounts some of the earlier influences, even within Cuban history itself, right? Like that is, when we talk about the Cuban Revolution, we assume that we're talking about the 1959 one, but how about the 1933? Like, this is one of the things that I in the book, I argue that it's not just the end of Prohibition, but also the Cuban Revolution of 1933 that made a massive impact in the changes in Miami's queer culture. I mean, these kinds of things have us think very differently about what we accept as you know, established narratives, and kind of putting all these pieces together gives a fuller, much more textured, I hope anyway, narrative that allows us to think even, you know, a little bit differently about how we might understand the development of these spaces.
Absolutely. If there's anything your book does, it's make us think differently about a lot of different things.
Well, thank you.
I would agree with that. Thank I would you. Definitely, yeah, agree with that. You know, I guess, you know, we've been talking for 40 minutes, ooh. So starting to wrap up.
Yeah.
I did want to ask, I did notice that, yeah, you ended with like the Jewel Box Review,
yeah,
which really ties that epilogue to the post-1940s queer history that maybe perhaps hasn't been written extensively from a highly academic perspective, but we're very familiar with that, you know,
yeah.
I think within LGBTQ communities. So I wanted to ask, one of the differences, I think, in your book, in terms of like many of the social urban histories that people have written about earlier, like you mentioned George Chauncey, and he is that he uses the word gay. And of course he uses the word gay tied to the historical context.
Yeah.
And he explains that in his book. It doesn't necessarily translate that at the title level to the
right.
rest of society,
right.
but you know, he was definitely a historian's historian in that sense. But yeah, can you talk a little bit about queerness as it's used by historians? And I'm just curious what you think about this, because I heard you when you were talking about the dailies,
mm-hmm.
that you found that you're going to digitize.
Yeah.
I think I may, correct me if I'm wrong, heard you say, you know, queer and trans cultures from this earlier period.
Yeah.
But trans doesn't appear in your book as a central word. So I was curious, what are the possibilities there for people doing queer history?
Oh, like another really great question. So no, you're right. Like as a trans, as a kind of analytic, I would say kind of distinctly so, doesn't appear in the book in that kind of way. It's not articulated that way, but it is, I use queer as an analytic that provides space for trans embodiment and trans subjectivity in this kind of in a capacious way, right? That is, for me, as I use the word queer in Miami, in large part, I like the example you gave with the use of the word gay in George Chauncey's text, because for me, right, I found no evidence that there was a kind of that the word gay had achieved any kind of capital, right, in Miami's early culture, at least until in the period that I was covering. And I would say that's largely true of queer in the sense that it, you know, that we might associate it with it today. It allowed me a kind of, because of that, it allowed me to use queer in a more capacious way, I think, that allowed me to think about transgression more broadly. Like, what is it that, how questions of transgression and normativity change and, you know, the kind of ebbs and flows, how certain things become acceptable, how certain things don't become acceptable or become prohibitive, and a number of kind of criminalized, right, how these things change over time. And one of the things that, you know, becomes pretty clear to me, and I stress in the book, is that gender transgression, right, is at the center of more, far more of these questions. It's really the kind of central preoccupation than what we might imagine to be sexual transgression, right?
Mm-hmm. You can't see me, but I'm snapping my fingers.
Oh, good. I'll do. You can't see me, but I'm joining you. Right? That seems weird. I'm like snapping at myself. But that's. I mean, that is. And actually, right. That so much of Gay New York suggests something very similar. Actually, right. Mm-hmm. Like what kind of embodiment is the fairy? Right. Like, I mean, how are we to understand the kind of queerness of the fairy outside of trans subjectivity, right? The possibilities of it's also where the field is today versus where the field was in the 90s, no doubt, and where the literature has had us think very differently, and no doubt that a lot of that has to do with you know, I'm just as influenced and inspired by works in critical race theory and in ethnic studies and Black studies to kind of put these, you know, how do we not understand transness and its relationship to race and Blackness after reading C. Riley Snorton, you know, like all these kinds of really important questions that I hope kind of, you know, come out in the book, right? That, but no doubt I would argue that the book itself shows that gender was a far more important indicator to triggering these kind of key questions than what we might read as sexual transgression.
Mm, yeah. I love how you put all of that. And also interesting that Gay didn't have that kind of purchase that it did in New York during this time period.
It's a smaller place too, you know, like in it's sheer numbers, like less texture as the city, no doubt. Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, and I can just imagine like being queer earlier in that period. So much of it is subtle. Like communication networks are subtle.
Yeah.
And how do we literalize that on the page? You know, there's it's an impossible project in some ways.
You have a great way of phrasing things. I'm so jealous. Like, I love that. It's true. I love that.
Thank you for all your compliments today.
Oh, it's true. It's true. It's very sweet.
Oh man. But so I just wanted to wrap up with you telling us what you're working on now. I know you did that a little bit earlier. But if you could, what's the most exciting thing you're working on now, and what do you want people to know?
Whew. So I'm excited about a number of grant-funded projects, including the building of a Miami Studies program here at FIU that is generously funded by a National Endowments for the Humanities grant. I'm working on two big Mellon Foundation grants that we were fortunate enough to win that put at the center decolonizing archives, working with local community partners. I mean, it's a dream of a project for me. The digital exhibition that will be free and completely accessible to everyone on the HIV/AIDS posters from around the world should be out in May. I'm really, really excited about that. So look out for that. And I'm revising, the kind of, goodness, somebody called it the sequel the other day or something like that. And I was so offended. Like, I don't know. Like, I mean, I see them as really different. not that sequel, whatever. Anyway, so it's kind of queer Miami post 1940. I'm revising that currently. And I'm really excited about the, you know, all these kind of, the way that we kind of reach and do work in service of the communities that we are, of course, researching and doing work on. That I also see myself, of course, as a critical, that as I'm a member of these communities, right? That is, and I feel very fortunate to be invited in and to remain in, like even after all of this. So thank you for letting me plug some of that stuff. I appreciate it.
Of course. And you're from Miami too.
Right? I am. I'm born and raised here. Yeah. Yeah.
That's great. That's so wonderful that you're able to write a book on your own roots, you know.
It's true. I have to say it wasn't even like a topic that came to me, you know, like naturally or something, right? But I was asking kind of different questions, and then I was like, I think this all kind of comes to the fore and when we think about Miami, and then it kind of through a number of great conversations with people I really admire and trust, I was like, wow, maybe I should write about Miami. But also I feel like sometimes we underappreciate some of the own skills we have. That is, I didn't the language, right? Like to you know, speaking Spanish or French and to do kind of these kinds of things that I don't want to say we take for granted, but living in a trilingual city, largely trilingual, you know, you don't realize that some of these things are you're able to do some of this work in large part because you're a product of it, right? Like, so it kind of made me ask some different questions about the work that I was already really interested in as someone who is from here.
Yeah, absolutely. And I agree with you about certain times we may take for granted or undervalue our own skills that the academy has undervalued, but that, you know, our own communities, it's part of our survival. So
now I'm snapping. Yeah.
That's hilarious. Well, I'm definitely going to keep an eye out for the HIV AIDS exhibit that'll be, you know, online and freely accessible. And everybody else should keep an eye out as well. Thank you very much for joining me today and for giving this talk on Welcome to Fairyland. I hope it can be used by many people, graduate students who are reading this, et cetera, or who are listening and reading your book. But thank you so much, Julio.
Thank you, Leo. I really, really appreciate it. And the conversation was really awesome. I appreciate the time and energy. Thank you so much.